Welcome to the June 18, 2019 session of TeamSpeak for Tangerine SD. My name is Dave, KV0S, and this week I did a little bit of work on checking out some of the old videos and making sure that they worked. And I found that we, on the OpenHP SDR, have lost a few. Mainly because of changing formats and web servers, but mostly all the videos are there. So I did that and have been working a bit on pulling out the old OpenHP SDR programmer and re-familiarizing myself with the changes and what's going on there. So that is about it for me. Next on the list we have Mike, AAAK, shown as away, Mike muted and recording, and we thank Mike for recording the TeamSpeak the TeamSpeak session to teamspeak.archive.tangerinesdr.com. Next on the list we have Rick, W2GPS, he's shown away, and then we have Tom, N5EG. Go ahead, Tom.
Oh, good evening, Dave. Glad to be here. Glad to see everyone. This week has been mostly writing specs, and Rick has given me a lot of help. Turned around a second.
Very good. And next on the list, we have Scotty, WA2DFI. Go ahead, Scotty.
Okay, thanks, Dave. And thanks for running this. Really a help. And again, thanks to Mike for hosting. This week has been pretty hectic getting ready for field day this coming weekend. So I haven't really done a lot, although I did work a little bit on the protocol, which maybe I can discuss, but I'm really trying to get it written down somewhere for this, the LCC protocol, so that it can be discussed in a more intelligent light than just having me wave my hands and try to explain it. Probably wouldn't do very well. And I haven't had a chance to get the drawings out for the mechanical arrangement that I had envisioned for the boards too. I'll try to get to that. I may not get to it until after field day. We have some equipment problems here. It's causing some trouble. So that's about it for this week. So back over to you, Dave.
Well, fine business. And next on the list is Dan, N4XWE. Go ahead, Dan.
Well, I did take the time to read everything last week after the meeting, unfortunately. And I think I'm pretty well up to date. Also did a little bit of looking at some of the components that we discussed, better hand exactly what we're talking about. Other than that, not much going on except where it got a little. So back to you, Dave.
Well, fine business. And that brings us to the end of the list. So we're open for general discussion.
It looks like Rick is back.
Hello.
Hello, Rick. You want to make any comments?
Well, I learned a lot working with Tom on the specific by making comments that sometimes not have been right on the mark and getting good answers. I think I'm getting up to speed. Much participation is the key. So, yeah, the spec is out now and in its next iteration, I guess. I'm happy.
Well, that's good.
Go ahead, Dave.
Oh, I'm done. Go ahead. I was just moderating.
Oh, okay. I was just going to tell Tom that I haven't had a chance to read through the spec yet, but sounds like you guys have hammered out a bunch of stuff that will be good, because really I want to, I'm kind of looking forward to that, to steal the critical pieces out of it and put it in the requirements for the Tangerine clock module, because I think the two specifications will be different. There's one that's the requirements for the personal space weather station, and then there's that will fold directly into a clock module for the Tangerine that should meet all those specifications. Is that the way you see it too?
Yeah, that's the specification, the more difficult of the two, and so it should be easy to less expensive. One of the things I learned, I looked at John Ackerman's measurements and did a little bit of computation on, and there's quite a bit of phase one in the module that he has for measurement. I don't really know exactly what the source of that. John's going to try to make some more measurements of it, gets a chance. He ran his initial tests with alt set, and he's going to try some. The oscillator tends to dither frequencies rather than trying to converge in the single discipline. I'm not sure why that is, if it's set, if there's some. And so we'll kind of, I think John's going to have to do some measurements before this. One key thing you may want to look at without having to do any reading is the block diagram, just to make sure that
Okay, and you're talking about the LEA M8F, right?
Yeah, that's the module that we've made some measurements on.
Yeah, I noticed he had said that the frequencies kind of jumped around, and his theorizing was that the average frequency then averages out just fine, but that the instantaneous, you know, is off. So in other words, this might be a timing product rather than a radio product.
Well, it's supposed to be a frequency. The F on the end, I think, perhaps means frequency. But yeah, it's moving around like half a part per billion on, you know, maybe a 10 second of periodicity. So it'll be below frequency for a couple of seconds and then switch up 10 seconds. I don't know why that is. Maybe the internal D to A that's steering the oscillator, or maybe the test is just being the provision value table. I'm not really sure.
Well, I have a comment on that, Rick. I have a different theory as to why that is, but it doesn't really matter. They're just theory. I do have is a working circuit that can test that the oscillating steer not for good if the steering is. I have a circuit M8F and can either steer oscillator like John's test did, or can steer a high quality external OCXO. Some of the specs of which and I don't have to change any hardware to make the selection, which is rather convenient. And it's all in software. The problem I'm having is I'm trying to get a hold of the phase test measure device that John's using because I need one anyway. And that's a long story. But anyway, I should have bought one when easily available from John Miles. Anyway, there's also learners, as you found in the relate to how the steer is accomplished. An awful lot of parameters there tweaked. We don't quite know what'll happen when you do that. So that's the one thing John is supposed to do.
Yeah, were you able to get a more constant discipline frequency out ounce up?
Well, the deal is that this is a good OCX. Well, it's not super. It's not $3,000. I have one of those too, but it's a like $100 OCXO. And it has a accuracy, basic accuracy that's much, much better, like two orders of magnitude at least, maybe better internal oscillator that John tested. And so its end-to-end steering is much smaller, and therefore the least significant bit steers an incremental frequency than the internal one. And so the answer is yes, it's much less noisy in terms of being around. However, that doesn't a problem. It over a long period of time, it seems to wander about 10 degrees in phase, more than I would like, or about 1 to 2 for my applications. The F, by the way, is not for timing, or not for frequency. The F stands for flash, the historical thing going back to the LEA-6s. And one last comment on the M8F. There is a statement in the spec that I criticize, comment on, that says we have to protect against antenna short circuits. M8F will not do that, even though it says it. In fact, the M8F will not meet. There was no specification insisted on for the antenna port, but the
You're talking about the power supplied to the GPS antenna that is not short protected.
It is supposed to be. The antenna. Antenna, the voltage for the antenna is something else. And there's an internal bias T in the printed circuit is the module M8F. The M8F is not a part. It's a printed circuit board with a cover. The bias T includes a current sense resistor, which is way too big. It's 1 ohm. And partly that's to protect the bias T from running out. But the fact is it doesn't. Bias T is much too good. If you short the antenna, you'll burn out the bias T, thereby making the M8F inoperable. That is, say, it won't drive the antenna anymore. And I've done a considerable amount of study and external circuit for my products. That's two complex projects, so I'm trying to figure out what to do about that. The M9 seems to fix that. The M8F also eliminated a very pin. It was for an external, a very minimal external that sensed under and would report also that it was open circuit as well as for short circuit. The M8F will do the open circuit reporting because they needed another pin to do some of the oscillator steering. So they stole T. Now, there's some real problems with the MADEF, but we'll put our heads together and get around those. As long as I make you aware of them, I think that'll be enough for now. The design phase will figure out good, affordable solutions.
Okay, that's interesting. The spec says
it is. It's limited until it burns up its internal bias T. It won't hurt the external, anything external, that's for sure. But it will burn itself up. And once you've soldered an MA onto the circuit board, it's almost impossible to get it back off. So it's not replaceable. Winds up blowing the board then. And that's not nice. So that's something we'll have to sort out if we decide. Otherwise, the MADEF's an excellent.
Okay, well, I noticed inherently there's a Texas Instruments to Aiken that you can just marry I2C, and I guess the parts capable of running that D to A to discipline an oscillator.
That's one of the two ways you can discipline an external oscillator, and it's very effective, and I believe that D to A is rather inexpensive. It's not the method I use in my products, but it doesn't matter. It's equivalent. It produces exactly the results.
Okay, that sounds really good. I found a little bit of pricing dual channel module, but I don't trust them under two prices, and so I'm not sure. The dual channel solution looks nice, but the price tag seems about a factor of five.
I recommend Octopart for searching for part prices.
I'll have to look that up.
It's a site that is owned by Altium, but they don't insist even know that site. It searches a dozen or so vendors for issue stock and pricing at once. Very handy. And if, like me, you happen to use a designer for schematic capture, modeling, and a PC board layout and so forth, it's integrated into there as well. So doing your schematics, if the part prices are as you lay the parts on the schematic.
Yeah, there's another one that does that too. It's called ECIA Authorized. Have you ever heard of that?
No.
Yes.
But that's why I'm here.
Okay. Anyway, it's called ECIA Authorized. And I don't remember whether there's a dash between the ECIA and the authorized or not, but it's .com. And it lists, similar to what you said, it's at least a half a dozen, maybe up to a dozen manufacturers of parts. And you can use wildcards and you can search for pieces of part numbers and things like that. So it's very good to find out if the parts are available, if anyone has them. So I'll put Octoparts in with that category, and I'll use both of them.
Good idea.
Okay, I'm typing notes here. If you have a link, you can post a link in the chat. I can capture the spell. So I'll take a note about the antenna current limit issue.
Yeah, that's I can elaborate offline on mails or whatever about that. Okay, that. Oh, you put it in here. Boing, happens. I don't have permission to send.
Are you over on the Tangerine SDR tab and not in the TeamSpeak server tab?
I mean, obviously, just down at the bottom of that sub.
Yeah, but there's two tabs there. One is the server and one is the
Tangerine. Oh, yeah, okay. Let's try it again. I didn't know that. I don't know anything about this stuff. Oh, look, it worked. Yep, that's the address.
Yeah, so one of the things that I did where I want to do is I'm going to take the D to A converter, the D to A converter and the temperature sensor off of the data engine. And I was just looking for comments to see if anybody thought that was good, bad, or indifferent. I don't really have any use for them. The reason I put the data, it's a low-speed DAC. It's for setting analog voltages, and it's a four-channel one, but it's expensive. And so I thought, well, you know, if you really need DAC channels, then put it on a shield board. Otherwise, we'll not put it on the baseboard because I don't really think I can't come up with a purpose for it, a reason to have it on there. And the temperature sensor, we have a temp sense diode in the FPGA itself, although it's kind of a pain in the neck to read. So I don't necessarily think we need to have a separate I2C ambient temperature sensor unless maybe someone can convince me you ought to put it on there. It's very inexpensive. It's only it's under a buck. But still, it's like the more things you can get rid of, the cheaper the baseboard's going to be.
Okay, so this would sensing for all applications or just for the one where you don't really care about that? Is there some other way to get?
Well, there's a temperature sensor or temperature diode in the FPGA fabric itself that you can read with a built-in A to D a low-speed A2D that the FPGA has. So you can still get the die temperature. You just can't get ambient temperature.
Okay. I don't know if we've identified a need for ambient temperature. I mean, it's one of those nice to have. I haven't seen them raise an issue about it so far.
Yeah, and I figured it's 80 cents. So, you know, you can put it on there and hook it to an I2C port. But, you know, I can't, like I said, I can't come up with the reason why I need it. So it's like, don't bother. And then we already have analog, low-speed analog inputs because the FPGA has an A to D on it. And we get, you know, I can provide four channels of that. We use that to monitor the power supply voltages in addition. So that, but that all comes free with the FPGA. The DAC outputs are not free. And, you know, if we have one that's going to be used for steering the oscillator, then that's going to have its own function that it has to do, and that'll be part of the oscillator module. But I can't come up with a reason why we have to have analog output set by DACs.
Yeah, I just looked up the DAC that uBlox recommends as their external DAC if you want to have an external DAC for an external oscillator, and I'm not happy.
Why is it expensive?
Well, way too expensive. It's depends. There's like four variations. They run in the 6, 7, 750. There's one that appears to be, no, that's not six. That seems, well, I guess when the modules, the module, there was a price. One of you guys looked up, I guess, the DigiKey price for the M8F, and I said I might be able to get it cheaper. I think the DigiKey price was, what, $64? Is that right?
Yeah, it ranged from like $99 in unit quantities to like 16 or something, 100 quantities.
I figured would probably buy 100 of them, and that was like $64.
Yeah.
And I have confirmed tentatively that I can probably supply them closer to 50.
That would be a big help in trying to meet the cost target.
Well, it might make up for the $6 DAC and maybe a better external CXO, $100. Anyway, just consider that, and I might be able to even do better than 50, but probably not. there's some issues uBlox is doing right now on pricing, changing, making things much more expensive.
Well, but Rick, in any case, you know that the oscillator that we use on Hermes, the Crystek oscillator, mm-hmm. that we paid all the money for, now I think in quantity it's down to around $15.
That's the kind of oscillator we need to look at, sort of in between the one that's in the module and the one I'm using that's $100. We need to find something in that range. If we had a $15 oscillator that was good enough, and if it took a $6 DAC to drive it and two resistors capacitor, that wouldn't be the end of the world, especially if I get the module down to $50.
Yeah, because then, I mean, you keep the whole thing, the whole BOM cost well under $100 that way.
Well, yeah, except the spec says an antenna, so that throws out $15 or $20. Not happy about that, but
right. Yeah, if you go to the M9F, then you have the super expensive dual band antenna, right?
I have also discovered just today, using other contacts, that there is a crowdfunded dual frequency antenna. It's not cheap, but it's not $1,500 like I told you. The antenna I have here is. It was $50 without cover and $330 with the cover. So $330 for an antenna, and it's already funded, fully funded, so you can just buy them.
Why is the cover so expensive?
Why is the cover so expensive? I don't know. It's got to be transparent at 1500 megahertz, I guess. But I don't know.
Just seems like, what did you say, 150 for the unit and 330 for one with the cover? That's like more than double.
Yes, it is. Yep. And I'm just saying that's available. It's the lowest price I've seen yet for a dual frequency amplified antenna. But it's just something I stumbled. At least we don't have to talk $500 anymore. And now we look for options less than $30 for the best.
Sounds good. Can you find that maybe and put the link down at the bottom?
Oh, God. All right. Let me see if I'll pull some.
I did a little looking at the M9 pricing. Only able to price on it was in. It was about cost of the.
I think that's about right for the moment. But I might be able to do better than that, but not in the short term. That's the problem. I hope we don't need it. We have to talk a little bit about what is really meant by accuracy and under what conditions we're willing to sacrifice our specs.
You get a lot less clout on getting a good price on a new product like that, don't you? I mean, they don't want to deal so much on the new ones for a while.
Well, what I'm trying to do is I'm buying up portions of reels so that my person I'm buying them can get that much more quantity. He's buying many reels. And the more reels he buys, the better his price is. So if I buy portions of his reels are 20 units. If I were to buy, say, 100 units, better almost half a reel, that helps him. And so he's willing to give them to me at cost. So that will apply to the M9 if he does an M9 product. That's the if.
Well, if he uses the M9, right?
Which he doesn't right now. Nobody does. And in fact, that U-Block showed up a week ago at his doorstep and said, where's my M9 development kit you promised me? And they said, I forgot them, you know. So we're on the verge of getting our hands on an M9 development kit. So we find out what. For instance, there's no evidence that I can see on the M9T timing I care about that it will steer an external oscillator. Well, that would change the game all over.
But there'll be an M9F, won't there? That would be more like what we would want to use.
They have not, as far as I can see, announced. And so I'm just saying, in the short term, hope we don't need an M9. We need to wait for the dust to settle on that.
Well, certainly, if the M8 could meet our requirements, that is a much more financially viable price than five times what the M8 costs.
Well, That's the if. And as I said, if you really need UTC traceability, because we're going to stations world, not in regions where they have similar ionosphere, then you're going to, outside of the spec, anytime there's a solar disturbance, meet the nanosecond spec during a solar. If we can live with that, fine. If we can't live with that, we need to mitigate it, but not mitigate it the way I had once hoped, using either what is now called SBAS, but it's the various augmentation system. We can't use those because there's a bug in the U-blocks when you're in precision. What we need for getting all these specs tightened, there's a bug in the U-blocks. And when I reported it, instead of them fixing it, they added a line in the manual that said, do not use SBAS position hold. I was hoping they would fix the bug, but instead, line of code. Well, SBAS was the other hope, mitigating ionosphere, and that's off the table for the moment. And so M9 went, so we're just going to have to.
So, Tom, don't we need a dual band receiver to do TEC measurements?
Yeah, I have not looked into TEC measurements at all, so much about that stuff. I think that's a common way to do it, but I'd defer that to Rick.
You probably do, yeah. I suspect. So, yeah, we got to keep our eyes on the M9 as soon as I get a hold, and we'll begin experiments, whether it actually does, and whether it's worth, because it's going to be expensive, at least in the...
Yeah, I left a placeholder in the spec, you know, saying the low price unit first. As dust settles, we phase two.
Well, yeah, that's the whole point of making it modular, so that you can come out with a reasonably priced one now, and then maybe, you know, next year when the M9... is more reasonably priced after it's been out a while and determined that it will work for TEC measurement. Maybe it could be a requirement for TEC measurement.
Yeah, I suspect the science project, one project won't need it, and then the next project, nice. At that point, if we can just do a module swap for the station, it may be easier to spend an extra than to try to pay for it.
Well, how will the using an M9 affect the pinout of our module? Because that's what I'm kind of focusing on is, I want a universal pinout that will be able to be expandable and use additional, say, more precision or dual band modules. We have to make sure and leave enough pins for that, or pre-assign them anyway.
Yeah, so that's where you might want to look at them in the spec. I tried to make the block diagram not depend which module, but there may not be sufficient.
I have a chart that shows the difference in pins looking at. And I just solder in place the M8T or M8F that I have now. And It's, well, let's just say, when I did the same thing with 6 series to the 8 series, you could lay the parts down, but there were significant differences on a handful of the pins, and that's true again. So if you want the same, use zero resistor jumper to select pins, what they do, because there's a handful of pins that have different functionality or allocated different.
Well, we could either do that or use a different board layout. I'm thinking for the M9, we use a different board layout. But if the M, you're talking about for different, configuring the M8 different ways, is that what you're talking about?
No. If you're willing to use different board layout, that's the best way. And it can be the same, it can plug in the same place. That's...
Yeah, the diagram on the clock module tries to come higher than that and says what inputs to inputs are needed. Irrespective.
Okay, good. That's perfect. I have to take a look at that, and I have yet to take the time to do that. It's been pretty busy. I definitely want to look at that because that, what I'm going to draw up is a interface specification for that connector. So that's, we've got to make sure that we can fit all the different variants that we can possibly come up with today into that same pinout.
Yeah, basically, that module has the GPS holdover. And it has the synthesizer, Hertz crystal for the synthesizer. And then it's got an SPI interface to seed synthesizer.
Yeah. So it sounds perfect. I mean, we have room for all the pins to talk to the SPI port. You have 4 oscillator outputs, right?
Yeah, I included a few more. You may want to look at it and comment.
So we can certainly reserve them even if we only use a 4-channel jitter reducer and then just not drive the other ones. But they're reserved for the future when we need more.
Yeah, that's, I didn't know if we would have a 4-channel or an 8-channel. I haven't looked pricing difference between them.
Yeah, I think for that part, it's 2, 4, or 10 are the 3 options for number of channels.
Okay, very good. I remember, I'll have to look up the price on that. Remember the crystal and the chip together being the 20-something, but now I have the links to go look.
Yeah, and Mike asked a question down there if he can use his house Thunderbolt GPSDO, and I think... You're planning a 10 megahertz reference input, right?
I put that on the diagram, an external 10 megahertz reference in.
And I'm thinking that perhaps if you have one of these multi-$100 clock modules, you wouldn't necessarily need a 10 megahertz reference input, but if you had a lower performance clock module, you might.
Well, yeah, I think it would be useful to put it on just for test purposes. I suspect there may be some cases where we put something just to make some comparisons.
Okay, yeah, and I have no problem with that. We put it on the connector and then can put an SMA on the baseboard to feed it.
Yeah, I suspect the majority of the applications it won't be used, but there's probably always a use case.
Has anyone here heard of the, I think it's a tour of the Green Bank radio telescope. It's happening at the beginning of August. It's actually the SARA Society of Amateur Radio Astronomers. I think Rick, you're involved in that, but they have their conference the first week in August.
Actually, I'm not involved in that except for the fact that Alan Rogers at Haystack is a friend of mine. He is area, but I haven't done anything there, so I wasn't aware of that.
Yeah, it looks like a 3 or 4 day seminar series. It's kind of frustrating because they don't put anything up about last year's seminar. And they don't have anything up yet about this year's speakers. They have the keynote, but they don't have anything else. And the keynote, I think, is about radar investigating the planetary objects in the solar system. So that sounds pretty interesting. And they actually have accommodations on site, which some of them are full and other ones are still available. And the package is really amazing. It's like $165 for your SARA annual membership and 11 meals and all the conference attendance. So it's a pretty reasonable.
Well, that better include all the meals if you've been out there, place to go.
Yeah, really. And they say there's if they run out of room, there's one local kind of low buck budget hotel, and the next hotel is like 2 hours away.
Yeah, it's. And leave your ham radio at home.
It says that you can't even run your phone in the observatory.
It's a quiet zone. No RF emanations.
You can't even run your computer except in designated shielded areas.
That's right. And don't wander around too much because within a couple of miles of that receiving telescope, NSA receiving telescope.
Yes, and Mike said diesel vehicles only. That's true. The gas vehicles are restricted to certain areas, and then they have diesel vehicles that drive you into the close-in areas for the tours.
Yeah, that's why I spend my time at radio observatories with high-powered transmitters like Haystack. At least I don't have to shut off my ham radio if it survives.
If it survives, I like it.
Well, I have to drive right past 2.5 megawatt transmitter with a 200-foot diameter dish, and I have to drive within 20 feet of that to get up to the Haystack offices.
So like the candy bars melt in your pocket?
Well, it's 400 megahertz. It's on the 440 ham band. So the front end of my ham rig is wide open as I drive by.
Yeah, there used to be a guy around here, Dan, you might remember him. Well, you know, I don't even remember his name anymore. That's terrible. But he used to service Muzak system. And so he had a big maxi van, and he'd drive around to all the Muzak sites and service their equipment. But the transmitters were up on South Mountain here, which is where all of the TV and FM transmitters are. In the back of his van, he had the biggest amplifier that, it's RF Concepts now. Whatever the biggest amplifiers were that this manufacturer made, he had one for every band from 6 meters through 1296. So, I mean, he had like a 300-watt amp on 6, a 250-watt amp on 2, and it went all the way up to like, he had some enormous amount of power even output on 1.2 gig. But he had the amplifiers mounted on angle brackets behind a seat in the van. So in the cargo area, he just had like dominoes, just one after the other, these amplifiers, and he had antennas in the spine down the middle of the roof. And he said when he would go up to South Mountain, where all the big transmitters were, he would turn the power off to everything. And he would drive up there, and he would look back, and he would see the transmit lights were on all the amplifiers, even though the amps were powered off. So you wonder what these poor amplifiers are doing, because, I mean, the relays are powered with RF detection, right? Well, the RF's coming in the antenna and getting into the RF section and keying the relays, even though the power's off.
Oh, yes.
Scott, did you get a chance?
His name was Jay. Anyway, go ahead, Tom.
I was wondering, did you get a chance to talk to Dr. Kim about the magnetometer?
I have not. In fact, I'm supposed to write an email to him, and I haven't done that either. So I've been derelict.
Oh, okay. No problem.
Yeah, because we're trying to figure out what kind of interface to use, right?
Yeah, we were kind of wondering if, you know, was it an assembled cert available? We have to calibrate it. What face do we need those things?
Yeah, and I think we wanted to inquire whether the one from the University of Michigan guys was going to be sufficient.
Yeah, or if it's even available as a product.
Yeah, I've been a little distracted, too. I've been trying to figure out how to wire my thermostats up, to substitute smart thermostats in my house, because the electric company here has decided that my old electric rate is now obsolete. So, see, they won't ever raise your rate, but they'll just make your old rate obsolete, and then you have to go on a new rate, which is like 50% higher. But that's not an increase. So, Dan, didn't you use a smart thermostat in your condo there when you were in there?
Thermostat.
Yeah, that seems to be the pick of the high end.
Yeah, Honeywell makes one. There are a couple others these days as well. I don't see much specific. Their price is going down a little.
Yeah, well, the ones I've been looking at have been, I think they're made by Honeywell. But the thing is that I don't really need all that fancy AI learning nonsense, because, you know, in Arizona, you can't just turn the air conditioning off or way up when you leave and expect it to catch up when you get back. Because if you come back at 2 in the afternoon, there's no way you're going to drop your house temperature 2 or 3 degrees when it's 120 out.
Yeah, that's probably true. I don't use the AI features. I didn't in Arizona either.
And so what did you just set up? Schedules for the time that you wanted it to not run so you could save money on your time of day electricity?
Yeah, that was pretty much it. It's fairly simple to do that from your app. It's not so simple thermostat.
Yeah, and pretty much all the ones I've been looking at have a phone app and a web browser. And Sensei was the one that I was looking at. Sensei, that looks like they're under $100, and they've got a web interface and a smartphone interface, and you can get reports from them up to 10 days. It'll store 10 days in the thermostat, and it'll even do geofencing, which I don't need. All I really want is, 4 different setback times, or I can specify the temperature at 4 different times during the day. So that really all I want to do is I want to keep the thing from coming on during peak
power times rip you off for power cost.
Yeah, that's understandable. Yeah, there isn't any exclusive day other than changing it to a level that not make your air conditioner come on. But I mean, Nest has basically the same thing. They store your usage for 10 days. And the only issue is if you use it and the Nest server, in other words, it's a Google server, you're pretty much limited to using just the thermostat. In other words, I guess what I'm saying is that the app actually runs through a remote server and the server next to.
Well, so do you still get your time span settings and all that?
Yes, you do. You get whatever is native to the thermostat, but you don't get anything. You can't change anything. You can't look at any information about the thermostat in the app. Look at the thermostat face.
Oh, okay. And did you use a remote room sensor or not?
I did not, no.
Yeah, because I'm trying to figure this out. I mean, I don't have any zones. I don't have any dampers that are controllable by the electronics. I mean, you have fan on off and you have compressor on off. That's it. So if you want to put a sensor in a room, I don't see how that's actually going to work, because if you want to, say, specify the bedroom is extra cool at night, it's also going to cool the rest of the house down because it blows out air in all rooms.
Yeah, I mean, if you have just single, not going to get magically get dual zone, air conditionable zone.
No, but what it does do is it'll override the settings in the other zones. There aren't any zones, but in the other rooms, the other sensors. And if you tell it, it'll pick the bedroom sensor for sleep time, and it'll set the temperature there, and whatever the rest of the house is, it doesn't care. And then during the rest of the times, like during away times, it'll go by the main sensor instead of the bedroom sensor.
Yeah, I don't think the Nest app does that, although I haven't really used a remote sensor, so for sure. I mean, I haven't. I've read most of the documentation before. I haven't seen that.
Yeah, so I'm thinking a simple one is better, so simple's always better. But every one of them that I've seen goes through a server. So I think if the server's down, you're relegated to adjusting it from the dial, which is very limited on almost all of them.
And the server was down.
Okay, well, enough of that. See what else on SDR. I've been going through trying to formulate how discovery and the protocol would work between multiple servers and multiple clients. And I think it's Charlie and I have been brainstorming it back and forth. I think we can make it pretty orthogonal so that any number of clients and any number of servers can coexist on a network segment, and they'll all discover each other. And the idea is to have the clients issue the discovery request. Every server responds, and then every client can establish a configuration channel with every server. And then through a configuration channel, you request a command channel. And then through a command channel, you can request multiple different streams, or probably one stream per command. And what I'm trying to do here is because the clients don't necessarily know about the server's hardware. So I'm trying to put the restriction on the protocol to have only one phase really have to understand the hardware. So in other words, if discovery works with all hardware and commands and streams work with all hardware, but to actually know how to set up a command stream, you have to know about the hardware and the radio. And that's so the configuration channel is the one that's going to have to know about that. And I think I want to follow Phil Harmon's example and use an XML descriptor from in the radio so that the client can query the radio and say, okay, what capabilities do you have? And then you'll allow him to set up based upon how many ADCs he has, how wide they are, and whether there's DAC present, and what all the custom hardware settings are, like we have low pass filters at.
Yeah, Scotty, is there any intellectual property available EGA, the parts of the free process?
I don't know. There might be, but I was kind of going to go on the HPSDR model, so to make it a little more familiar to the software guys like John Melton, who I hope will listen to this. And it's not the middle of the night over there. Give me some feedback on that. He seemed to. I've already emailed him and talked to him. He's, by the way, I don't know if you know this, but he's on our mailing list, so he's watching. And he said if we were to send him the protocol document, he said that it probably wouldn't be too hard for him to add the protocol to Pi HPSDR.
Okay.
Lin HPSDR.
So if he can add it to Lineage PSDR, and we can, and he has an IQ2 hardware, as does Dave. If we can give him some code to implement this new LCC protocol on an IQ2, that code would port right into our Tangerine data when we get it.
Okay, well, there's certainly value in doing things the same. That Bill, of course, need a consultant.
Yes, definitely. And I was hoping he would be here tonight. I probably would. It's probably better if I write this stuff down and do it like what you're doing with the specification rather than try to just explain it and have anyone understand.
Yeah, I think Bill's on his trip.
Oh, that's right. Didn't he say for like 2 or 3 weeks he's going to be absent?
Yeah, so I suspect that'll give you time to get the whole document.
Oh, good. And I dig myself into a really deep hole then, right, if I don't understand how networking works.
It's easy to do.
Scott,
go ahead, Dave.
Scotty, I had a question that's related. It's in the programmers. So the old bootloader programmer uses 65 or bit packets, and then the programmer uses 256 packets. I was wondering, is there anything about the FPGA that limits those packet sizes, or is that just the, because the bootloader was originally written by John, and then he had actually written the first version of the programmer, and so I modified it, but it basically follows the same procedure.
Well, the only limitations I know of is what Phil told me last week on TeamSpeak for OpenHPSDR is that UDP packets are a minimum of 60 bytes of payload, which is, I don't know, makes them like about 80 bytes long, something like that. And there's a maximum of about 1,500 bytes. I think it's exactly 1,500 on for Ethernet frames without going to jumbo frames. But as far as the 256, no, I think maybe, is it possible that was married up to the sector size in the ROM that they're writing?
It might be, and that's what I was wondering, if that was why they were doing it instead of sending, 1024 or something.
Yeah, because it would be really useful to make sure that your whole thing, the whole area. But then you want to program one complete sector at a time, one whatever the minimum unit for programming is.
Is there, I was looking at the MAX-10s, and I don't know if there's a place I can go to get some more I found the data sheet, but it doesn't really tell what I want to know. So I was curious if there's some other places I could look.
There are tons of documents on the MAX-10. They split it all up into programming information, and A to D information, and logic information, and so what is it you want to know?
What I have here is the data sheet that's development kit user guide, and maybe that's in the wrong place.
Okay, yeah, because if you just go to the Intel website and drill down into the MAX-10 documentation, you're going to find that there's dozens and dozens of different chapters. You know, they used to have like an FPGA user manual that was like megabytes long, and now it's split up into all small chapters. And you can either get PDFs or you can read them online.
Well, and I'm trying to figure out, Rick wrote this CRC, and it's a simple 16-bit CRC, but I'm not sure if it follows a standard protocol, because the programming language I have has like 15 or 20 different algorithms for generating the CRC, and I was wondering which algorithm. And really what I see is five or six formula, and I haven't worked enough with these to know all the formulas by name and that's this algorithm. So I'm trying to dig my way into it to figure out what's going on.
Well, if you look on the Intel website under the MAX-10 documentation, it's a couple of guides, actually, the MAX-10 configuration handbook or configuration guide, and it tells you all about the structure of the internal ROM and probably how to interface to it. And then there is a piece of IP that we place inside the FPGA. That's the actual IP that you talk to, and then the other side of that is the ROM. So you talk to that in order to program the ROM, and you need the info on that piece too.
Yeah, and what I was trying to figure out was what's the difference between programming a Cyclone 4, Cyclone 5, or MAX-10?
Yeah, that's a good question, because the ROM is internal in the MAX 10 and is external in the Cyclone. That'd be really interesting to see. I want to understand that too.
Well, anyway, I thought I'd ask the question and see if anybody already knew.
Yeah, there's a wealth of info, and there's a lot of reading to be done. I mean, I've built many MAX 10 boards, and I still don't quite understand all of it.
Well, I know we can make the process simpler and easier, and it's just finding the right secret sauce.
Yeah, you know, I followed one of those links that you put up on at the TeamSpeak session last Friday, and one of the things that I discovered was you had like some kind of web programmer. Is that something you wrote?
Yes, that's something I wrote.
Okay, that looked very interesting.
So I talked about that in DCC when we were in St. Louis.
Oh, okay. Are those talks up online?
Yes, they are. And I have written some printed instructions about it. But essentially what I do is I've been using the Go language. It's a 20% project at Google, and it's been used to build a whole lot of things. Actually, a lot of the infrastructure in YouTube is Go, although they use Ruby for the web pages.
So that is that the same as Golang?
Yes, it is. So I use that to produce the web browser and then write HTML code to interface it, and then use a little bit of WebSockets to communicate real-time changing.
Oh, okay. Because, remember the Internet Telegraph project that I talked about at DCC, I think 2 years ago? That's all written in Golang.
Oh, okay. So anyway, it's my favorite language right now. It's the one that I find reliable and testable, because I can build little bits and make test functions. It's the testing is built in very cleanly into the language. So it's C-ish. So if you've programmed in C, it doesn't seem that strange. And so I like several of those features, and I can make things fairly complicated, things that are clean and are tested and I know work.
That sounds like a bunch of good features. I'd have to look into it. I'm not really a programmer, but I like to dabble in, especially if it's not too hard to learn.
The only big disadvantage of Go is there's no GUI. So basically, but it does provide, it's only about 10 lines of code to make a web server.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm not afraid of command lines and things like that, so that's no problem for me.
So it's pretty easy to do that kind of stuff. And the nice thing is it compiles on most architecture. I have it, the compiler working on the Odroid N2 just fine.
Oh, really? And so it's a compiled language, so does it run pretty fast then?
Yes, and it there is a version of it you can run compiled, and there's a way that it appears to be like an interpreted language with a certain set of commands, and it has the look and feel of things like Python, but it's really still compiled. It's an incredibly fast compiler.
Okay, because I think Python's mostly interpreted, but like once you run it once, then pieces of it are compiled. That's not really clear on that.
It is getting that way, yes. And there are compilers. If you want to force it compiled, you can.
Okay, very interesting.
So there's lots of different ways to do it, but I have my, like everybody, you have your favorite way.
Yeah, and then you end up being able to do it better the more you use your favorite way.
Yep. Well, I'm going to have to take off, but I wanted to jump in there and ask my little question.
Oh, well, very good. I think, trying to keep this to an hour is a good goal, don't you?
Yeah, it helps keep my wife happy, so that's it. Well.
Yeah, I have to go home and work on the TS-50 now. This is the most bizarre thing I've ever seen, is when it talks to write log, it gives the wrong mode, but because the computer's reading the radio, but yet it reads the right frequency, but it gets the wrong mode, and they're rotated. So when you say LSB, you get USB. When you say FM, you get CW. It's just bizarro. So I'm ready to just throw the radio in the trash.
You know, I've written a couple of logger programs, one that went with QT radio and plugged into John's code, but we don't really use QT radio anymore. I haven't tried doing one with Lin HPSDR yet, but I was trying to build one that was a web-based Go one, but it's only about half built.
Yeah, there is a group that actually wrote their entire logging program for their multi-station field they set up. They wrote it all in Python.
Yep, you can do that.
That is truly amazing. But, you know, there's not enough hours in the day to play with all this fun stuff.